Segundo here, and I do apologize for the brief absence. I never thought I'd experience withdrawal, but the producers decided to restrict my tequila supply at the same time that they stopped production of these podcasts. Which is to say, there were no bottles of Cuervo waiting for me at my Motel 6 room door. I was reduced to walking through suburbs, trying to find a party, any party, and telling the man at the door that there was a friend of mine named Bob inside the house. If there's one universal constant, there is always a guy named Bob at parties. Once ensconced, I would make a beeline for the alcohol, sometimes tripping over young people who were learning the benefits of oral sex for the first time, and then plying myself with any elixir they had. Sometimes there would be tequila, sometimes there would be a strange green weed that the partygoers insisted that I smoke. What this anecdote has to do with this week's guest is, of course, no mystery. Sometimes you need to get the lay of the land.
So I am here with Richard Ford, who is the author of The Sports Writer, Independence Day, and most recently, The Lay of the Land. Richard, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Ed. Thank you.
I wanted to ask you first off about the question of realism, which your books, and particularly the Frank Bascom books, are very rooted in. Your work has been categorized by Granta, among a number of other places, as dirty realism.
Well, that's been 25 years ago.
Yeah.
I'm no longer dirty.
You're not dirty.
I'm not dirty anymore. My feet are all dirty, but that's...
How would you say you've kind of unsullied yourself?
I think I was never that. I think that was just a nail that Bill Buford, who was then the editor of Granta, and a very useful nail, although not exactly accurate, but it was a nail he hung a lot of what he considered to be new American fiction on. Me and Toby Wolfe and Ann Beatty and Joy Williams and even Ray Carver were sort of made to be suddenly dirty, whereas before we thought we were just kind of normal realists.
In your view, there is no sort of subclass of realism? Or?
In my view, no, there really aren't any useful subcategories of anything. There's just imaginative writing, and as Frank O'Connor says, there are limitless ways to create verisimilitude.
But you value realism above all compared to, say, you know, magical realism or Pomo kind of stuff.
For myself as a writer, I do. But for myself as a reader, I value a good book, really. If it's, so to say, magical realist, or if it's post-structuralist, or if it's nouvelle roman, if it's realism, I don't really carry those categories around with me. I just read sentence by sentence.
Well, let's talk about The Lay of the Land. I actually wanted to ask you about the water metaphor in this. We have Frank Bascom moving from Haddam to Seacliff, although Haddam actually does figure prominently into the equation. But there are very sort of interesting nautical motifs throughout the book that I found quite interesting. For example, when Sally is there and Wally comes in, she's wearing this kind of sort of nautical outfit. You have also, for example, Frank declaring that his hydrogen to Sally's oxygen. But at the same time, in Independence Day, you actually had a number of kind of, you know, there was one particular passage in that in which you sort of implied that there was this sea breeze coming from miles away. So I wanted to ask you, was the nautical motif moving from, you know, from an inland to a coastal town, was this something that you had been thinking about for many years?
That's kind of a lit 101 question. It's interesting, though, but I'll tell you. When I started writing The Sports Writer in 1982, I was writing that book with a sort of a substructure from one of my favorite books, the Joshua Slocum novel, Sailing Alone Around the World. And that really was, I guess you would say, a nautical motif. And that really did underpin a lot of my thinking about how that book progresses. And in some way, I think, and you're the first person to ever ask me this, in some way I think that sense of being at sea as a sort of principal metaphor, not that I even think too much about metaphors, unless they just kind of jump up and bite me, but that notion of being at sea has always been a sort of a potent notion for me. And I think in some ways Frank is often at sea. So moving toward the sea in The Lay of the Land, I think, is just happenstance, but in another way, you may be of the belief, I am not, but you may be of the belief that there is no such thing as happenstance, that everything is, guided by some providence or other.
But at the same time, you as author kind of set the rules in terms of the... And I would also point out that Haddam has become a very sort of colorful town over the course of the 3 years. I was wondering at what point did this town kind of become this sort of great character for you, comparing it to the sports writer. It's just, it actually, I'll ask this question first. I've got another one that's related to this, but Haddam as a character, when did you know that it was just an absolute town that, you knew was kind of sprawling with crime and with developments, with all these sorts of flashes of people that, Frank sees throughout the book?
I don't think of it as a character. I think of it as just the backdrop of what the real characters, which is to say the human beings in the book, do in the foreground. Setting for me is always just the context that makes what people do more plausible. And I invented Haddam out of what experience I have had and continue having in central New Jersey. And so for me, it was an amalgamation of a bunch of different places that I sort of organized under the name Haddam. And it never really was intended to be more than that, except as these books began to develop to be more about American cultural life and American spiritual life in the suburbs, it sort of rose to become a bit of a touchstone subject in and of itself, because in describing a town's housing stock, in describing moratoriums, in describing sprawl outwards from these little towns, that became for me a subject I never intended to find, but did find and then did use. But it never really caused me to think of place in these books, these three books, as anything much more than what I originally thought it was.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, place in these books is very important to Frank's inability to properly sort of parse the world around him. So therefore, as he's developed this kind of inability to kind of, this greater inability through the books to kind of really identify that there are problems here that he can't actually access, that he, despite his pride in humanity, can't communicate. Place would seem to me very, very much a character or very much important.
Well, I think then that means that the book has become partly your property and less my property. And that's okay, because all I care about, is that you, in formulating Haddam as a place, just stay faithful to the details of the book. And if that becomes interesting to you, well, then that's perfectly fine with me. It never quite got that interesting to me. I'm mostly always interested in just what I can have characters do and what I can have them say and how I can make them behave.
I wanted to ask you about the sort of, if we can actually take the supporting characters in this book, there's really sort of two types. Supporting characters who often come back, such as Wade from The Sports Writer, as well as minor kind of the flashes I was describing of people that Frank sees, like, the pilgrims in the first part of the book.
And the reenactors.
Yes, exactly. I'm wondering if these are sorts of things that come directly from, writing in Frank's perspective, or where this kind of originates from.
It all comes from my poor, impoverished little brain. And I think those are things that just populate my experience, not even my imagination. And they come into the book in behalf of me trying to bring to the page as much of my sort of accumulated noticings and accumulated experiences as I can, as a way, finally and fundamentally, of giving something giving Frank something to play off of, giving him something to think about, giving the novel something to see, giving him something to say something about or to remember. And it comes in really, again, in behalf of character.
Mm-hmm. So really it's all about character. But I guess what I'm sort of suggesting is that there's two types of characters, in the sort of direct supporting characters who Frank actually relates to and these kind of mini supporting characters. I'm wondering, what motivates the sort of the frequency of a character who crops up?
Well,
Fred Bascom has to deal with.
You're asking me to formulate something that I do spontaneously, and I don't really have a plan about that. I mean, I bring Wade Arsenault into The Lay of the Land because I specifically wanted to. I wanted to create a ligature between The Lay of the Land and the first of these books, The Sports Writer, And there are a couple of other characters who float through these books who actually really do have fictive existences in the prior books. And so that's just me trying to both give this book an attachment to the prior books and also take upon myself the challenge of seeing how possible it would be to age them and make them plausible. The other characters, the sort of less than substantial characters, are really just there as part of the landscape. They're really just there to give Frank, as I said before, an occasion to say something funny, an occasion to describe something humorously, an occasion to describe something in the book that will make the setting more plausible.
One thing that does tie into this, and one thing that makes, for me anyway, what I really love about the Frank Bascombe books, is the fact that you have these really taut yet lengthy sentences that are just completely laden with modifiers. When Frank goes ahead and decides to rip someone a new one in his description, he goes ahead and he lets loose. And I wanted to ask you about this. I have to admire the craft of these sentences. I'm wondering, you know, this may be a bit presumptuous of me to ask you about the sort of, you know, how your craft goes, but I'm very curious how such a sentence along these lines actually is formed and drafted.
Well, I think, first of all, you have to think that long sentences are interesting mm-hmm. and that they're not a pain in the ass. And if you don't think that they're a pain in the ass, well, then I think that's me you're talking about, that I'm willing to undertake to write them. I think, insofar as they represent some of the style of this book, that they are owing to the fact that as I've gotten older, I have not gotten smarter, but I have really experienced a lot more, and I remember a lot more. And the style of a book is at least partly the sort of evidence, the syntactical evidence of a writer trying to make his sentences as full as possible, mm-hmm. trying to make the experience of reading be as felicitous, as rich and enriching, as interesting as he can. So the more I have come to accumulate over the years just by living a regular human being's life, the more interested I am in the material that I accumulate, and the more accumulation there is.
Did you feel that this was the last Frank novel?
Yes, I did.
You did?
And it is.
It is? You're sure? Well, I'm wondering then why you didn't set this at Christmas, because it seems to me that starting from Easter and then going from the resurrection of Christ to the birth of Christ would have been a very nice sort of dovetail effect.
Well, you would have to care about Christ for that to make any difference. Oh. I happen not to.
Gotcha.
I mean, when I started writing The Sports Writer, I sort of knew something about Easter, but I didn't know very much. But I am decidedly not a Christian mm-hmm. and not a religious person at all. And moreover, that sense of appropriateness of Easter all the way around to Christmas is an appropriateness I don't recognize. Mm. So in other words, your sense of symmetry is not matched by any sense of symmetry that I possess.
But that's where irony comes in. I'm not necessarily a Christian either, you know.
What's the irony?
Well, the irony is that you go from the resurrection to the birth as one man, you know, you go in an inverse kind of
Well, that's your
trajectory.
Novel. That's your three novels. That's not
I'm just curious. That's all.
Well, I'm telling you that your curiosity is of no consequence to me.
Okay.
But
sure.
I mean, I'm not combative about it. But
oh,
I mean,
I know.
But I mean, except in this way, that sense of irony, that sense of coming full round from Easter Christ's birth to Christmas Christ's death, is for me just a bunch of baloney.
Yeah, but at the same time, when you look at how embedded religion is in America, and when you consider the Bascombe novels as this kind of portrait of America, which I would argue that it is in some degree, or maybe you can answer, are the Bascombe novels intended as this sort of portrait of America? Or
if you read them that way, I don't think I can actually comment on that. There are a novel about specific people doing specific things at specific times. And if they engage you to think about America in the larger than just a specific sense, then, and again, your notions are faithful to the evidence of the book, then I'm okay about that. But I would never undertake, because I don't think it would be interesting, to write three novels over 25 years that were a portrait of America. It just wouldn't occur to me. People have said that they are.
Yeah.
But when they say that they are, I just demur. Mm-hmm. That's not what I'm interested in, really.
What are you interested in, really?
How much time do you have, Ed? I've just written, just finished writing about 1,200 pages. That give you some evidence of what I'm interested in.
Certainly. But I mean, at the same time, going back to this issue of whether the Bascom novels are a portrait of America, something specific like, this bar fight that erupts simply because Frank has voted for Gore, really indicative to me of America, because he, by uttering one simple political choice, he gets in trouble. He gets a broken sort of thing. So that is a kind of, is that a commentary on just everyday life, or is that a commentary on America?
It's a scene that I made up with two people doing two specific things.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what it is.
So,
I know that this novel is political in some ways because it takes place in a political season.
Sure.
And it takes place at the end of the millennium, or if you prefer, the beginning of the millennium, and it takes place the year before 9/11. But the things that I am most particularly interested in, again, are just the characters and what I can make them do, which I think is a quite ambitious set of undertakings. Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, setting it so specifically on the kind of turn of the nation, both politically, culturally, socially, that suggests to me a sort of not just being interested in people, but being interested in this sort of broader kind of cultural scope.
Well, good. But I can't say more about that than I've already said just by writing the book.
Okay.
I mean, if you spend, as I did, four plus years writing this book, I can't provide a gloss for the book in 5 minutes when it took me all these years to write it the best I could write it up to now.
Speaking of which, I was really kind of curious about part three in this book. I don't want to give it away, but it seemed in light of the fact that the first two parts were these really lengthy sorts of days, it seemed to me quite a bit of a surprise that part three ended the way it did. I was wondering if this was a situation where maybe you can talk about sort of the design of these days, because Frank undergoes
didn't have designs.
Really? You just kind of wrote with one continuous draft?
I did. And to the extent that each day is shorter than the other, that was something that I realized was happening as I wrote it, and took credit for, because when I thought about it very carefully, I thought, yes, that seems like the right thing to do. The fact that violence intervenes and cuts short day three seemed to me, and I was aware that that's what happened, seems to me that that's the way violence intervenes in our lives, that it doesn't allow the dovetailing of events, that we live in an extremely violent society in America, and that violence in some ways touches us one way or the other almost every day. And sometimes it actually enters our life and touches us vividly and dramatically.
When you insert violence, however, along those lines, I've read a few reviews that have suggested that this is a sort of deus ex machina, that it's kind of like it sort of resolves the plot of its own accord. I mean, is this the kind of risk of like placing something sudden, or how do you know when something is right, when a sort of major kind of dramatic intervention is just absolutely precise?
Because you think about what you can do as an alternative, and you think about all of the long lines of the book and how they lead to this, and how such an event creates opportunities for more writing in the book, and what consequences they have in the narrative, and then you just appraise it on that basis. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't read the reviews of this book, so deus ex machina, that's just somebody showing off.
Fair enough. Well, I mean, at the same time, if you don't read reviews, I know you've reacted in the past quite extraordinary to reviews, like shooting books.
My wife did that.
Okay. Also, like, the Colson Whitehead situation. Why react? Why even,
This is something that's not any of your business.
Okay. Fair enough. I wanted to actually ask you about Frank Bascom's culinary habits in this book. This was very interesting to me because, on one hand, he really like sort of pines for hospital cafeteria food. And there's also that frozen burrito that he actually picks up at the convenience store. And it just, for me anyway, it's just utterly sort of appalling. But all this kind of was reminiscent of like he's preparing himself for a stay at the rest home. I was wondering if the food aspect of Frank was something you really sort of thought about in this.
I just thought about it at the moment. I thought Frank's hungry. It's the middle of the day. He's not feeling very good. He doesn't have time since he's been kicked out of the place where he normally eats. And it's not just hospital food. It's good hospital food. Mm-hmm. So he just wants to put something in his belly. And so he goes into a 7-Eleven, basically, and grabs a burrito and heats it up and eats it, a sin for which he pays richly for through the rest of the day. Sure. But it didn't have any other moorings than that. It was just, I got a guy, he's hungry. I'm writing the book. He's in the middle of the day. He hasn't eaten anything on stage the whole of the day. So I want to have him eat something. What can I have him eat? Well, I could have him go to a restaurant. I could maybe have had him go to the hospital, which didn't work out. So it was just, the question that writers of novels and stories and poems are always facing. What do I do next? What do I do next? And I would not hesitate to suggest to you that when you answer that question, it's not because of some grand plan or scheme. It's because it's just what you've devised to answer at the moment.
So for you, it's really a matter of kind of getting Frank from one point to the other when you actually write this book.
That's exactly right. Yeah, but it's not just getting him from one point to the other. It's getting him from one point to the other in a way that's interesting, mm-hmm. and that elicits from me the best kind of writing I can do.
At the same time, there's something really quite astonishing that the way you have Frank go through what, you know, is fairly quotidian, and yet going back to these sort of layered sentences, they become quite astonishing and quite interesting and quite marvelous in their own way.
And that just owes to my belief that there is no real quotidian when you look very closely at the world, mm-hmm. which is to say, if you look closely through the eye of an imaginative writer, which is what I am, that what you find is a great deal more of interest than you might have thought were you not entering him through the eyes of an imaginative writer.
To bring up another famous Richard Yates, is the telling detail of importance to you? For example, a particular sort of gesture? Or
no, it actually isn't. No.
You're more of an instinctive writer, it seems to me.
Well, I don't know that there's really a distinction to make. I mean, that's a critical term. I don't know, did Dick Yates ever talk about the telling detail?
No, but when you read, for example, you know, Revolutionary Road, it is just completely laced with details that immediately sort of indicate to us what's going on with these particular characters.
Well, I would rather just tell you what's going on with them. I would rather just have, in this instance, Frank Bascom tell you what he's thinking or speculate about what someone else is thinking rather than make it a mystery that has to be plumbed through sort of Joycean, epiphanic, slightly obscure details. For me, it's worthwhile to try to say the unsayable, not indicate the unsayable by these details.
So, but at the same time, you're also a very sort of visual writer in the sense that you really are kind of chronicling what Frank is seeing as he sort of goes by. Do you feel that the perception is more important than what he's actually doing?
No, I don't think, again, that there's a distinction between those things. It's all language, and some of it is language that purports to be descriptive. Some of it is language that purports to be analytical. Some of it is if there's other some other category of writing, I don't know what it is for the moment, but to me it's all just language, and what I'm trying to do is to get the reader to be suffused in language, because I think language is itself carries value in and of itself. It's felicitous in and of itself. It's beautiful, even at some remote extremes, and that to be made aware of language, almost irrespective of what it's doing, is a good thing for the reader.
This reminds me of the street names in the book. They have very interesting names like Timbuktu and Poinsett and things like that. I was wondering what you did to sort of design these streets, or did you just kind of stumble upon a word that sort of struck?
I just stumbled upon a word. Yeah. Timbuktu seemed to be funny. because I think the book is fundamentally comic. And so to have a street be Timbuktu and have it come up subsequent times in other contexts is always amusing. It's always funny. I mean, so much of a book is a matter of happenstance and accident and things that can't be planned. And what you hope is, in the writing of it, that your plans will give way to even better kinds of strategies and even better kinds of sentence writing and even better kinds of words than you could have anticipated.
Do you sort of remove yourself from the influence of writers you've read when you write a book?
Well, you know, I don't know. I think when I wrote The Sports Writer, I was probably much more aware of Walker Percy and Joseph Heller and Frederick Exley as sort of the precursor writers to that book. And as time went on, I think I thought about them less. Mm-hmm. And those were formative for me in writing The Sports Writer. But into Independence Day, I think I wrote away from those influences.
When did you know? What book did you know? Was it Independence Day that you knew that you were writing, you had your absolute voice, that there was no sort of, you know, that really very little that other things you read would actually sort of, you know, imprint themselves upon your work?
I never really worried about that very much. I worried about it some, but I never worried about it very much. And I've never been preoccupied by writing sentences that sound like no one else but me, because I think, A, I'm writing realistic novels in English in sort of a standard way of referring to the world. Tree on the ground means a tree on the sentence. And so there are already so many inheritances from other writers that I just don't get preoccupied by it, because I think they're always going to be there.
I wanted to actually also ask you, going back to this question of language, the sort of terminology that Frank uses is not just Frank, but the permanent period.
Yes.
It's interesting that his daughter Clarissa is using the Harvard words and things like that.
Yeah.
I was wondering if this was kind of your response to the self-help industry.
Well, again, in Clarissa's character, when she's using words that Frank says are words she learned at Harvard, that's just me, the author's sensitivity to language and how language can become fetishistic and really, in a way, stop meaning what it used to mean. With the permanent period and the existence period and the periods that are talked about in the other book, that was me trying to elevate a period of life, in this case the permanent period, the middle 50s, out of the duff of our everyday to a level that we can see it and recognize that it is a period of life, whereas we might have just skated over it and never noticed it and never made full use of it. I mean, Sartre says that to give names to things that didn't have names is to elevate them to a level upon which they can be reflected upon. And so that was me just taking an otherwise innocuous period of life, elevating it to the point we can see it, giving it a name, and letting us and Frank think about it.
Well, there's certainly advantages to this for Frank and for humans, but at the same time, it's also kind of his downfall, because he identifies specific sort of people and he believes that they will act certain ways, but it actually comes to, you know, bite him in the ass later,
Well, that's just normal life, it seems to me. Yeah. That does just happen to all of us.
I actually wanted to ask you, because you've remarked in other interviews that dyslexia has helped you as a reader, but I would also argue that it's helped you as a writer, going back to this whole sentence thing.
Probably has.
Yeah.
It's made me sensitive to those aspects of language, which are not just the cognitive aspects of language. We normally think that language is operable to communicate ideas to us, communicate information to us, bring us the news. But language also has so many other properties. It has sonority. It has its appearance on the page if we read it. It has cadence. It has all of these poetical qualities, which are perhaps not information bearing, but bring us more sensuously close to our lives And so in that way, being a slow reader, as I always have been and am now, I think I was made to become aware of those properties just because I lingered so long in sentences.
How much of a visual writer would you say that you are?
Well, I think I'm probably a pretty visual writer in this regard. Whether I'm good at it or not, I don't know. But I do like to use words on the page that will cause the reader to have a picture in her or his mind of something. As I said before, a tree, a 47 Oldsmobile, something that I see in my mind, and that's probably the reason that I want to put it in the book, because I see it in my mind and I like the word that represents it, and I want to portray that to the reader in a way that can happen to the reader too.
Gotcha. There's a moment late in the book where the narrative is actually interrupted by Sally's letter. Yes. And I was wondering if the voice of Frank sort of sometimes becomes, how much of it do you love and how much of it do you hate? Or was this kind of an interruption for you or for the reader? Or
I never hate it. I always love it. And I had to work at that letter to make sure, even though Frank narrates the letter to the reader, but it's a letter that he narrates in a voice that is not his voice. So I had to work very hard to be sure that I didn't make Sally sound like Frank.
Sure.
I wanted Sally to sound like Sally. Sure. But I never get tired of Frank's voice, because it's a voice that I have such faith in, and the faith that I have in it is that it will allow me to bring as much of my, so to speak, skill sets as a novelist to the page. What I remember, what I can devise, what I can describe, what sensuous experience I can create on the page, my own preoccupations, all of those things, to become sort of fully operable as a novelist, you really want to invent structures and conceits that will allow you to bring as much as you can write to the page. When young novelists don't do that, it's because they haven't quite figured out yet to make the vessels that the books become capacious enough.
Are there any advantages writing in Frank's voice versus, say, omniscient voice? Or?
It's easier for me. I always have found that writing in the third person somehow restricts the sort of moral sympathy that I can get onto the page, so that I have to work really hard in a way that I don't have to work really hard in these Bascom books and in other first-person narrations that I've written, really hard to make the whole readerly experience full enough. I look to Alice Munro for those kinds of help, and 'cause she, more than any writer that I know writing now, manages to use the third person in that most capacious of ways, to be as intimate with the characters as would be the case in a first-person narration, and yet still provide the kind of omniscient commentary and amplification that comes with that point of view.
Maybe you can describe more specifically what capacious means to you in terms of...
It just means that a novel has a kind of spaciousness in it. It's roomy, and its roominess invites filling from the experience of the writer, and becomes then, once it takes its place on the page, an enriched experience for the reader.
Do you find it easier to actually sort of write in this kind of roomy air as opposed to, say, a short story or a novella?
No. I just think that spaciousness in novels is endemic to novels, and that short stories have their own economies and they have their own aesthetics, and I find each of them challenging in their own way, and one not necessarily easier than the other. Actually, I guess if I had to think about it a little further, I would say that short stories are easier to write than novels.
Do you need a challenge when you write a book?
Oh, I have plenty of them. I'm dyslexic, that's one of them. And I'm 62, that's another one. I have books that I've written previously which are challenges insofar as I don't want to repeat them. The challenge is to find new, even when some of the formal features are the same, to find new material, to find new structures, to find new conceits, to find new takes on language. So those are always challenges.
It's interesting, going to a sort of interesting sort of obverse similarity between Independence Day and Lay of the Land, where you have in Independence Day this couple who Frank has showed like 45 houses. Yes. And in this one, you have a couple. It's like, hey, we're ready to go ahead and do it in cash, and we're not even going to look at the inside.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The bagashes.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was just... I was conscious of not wanting to repeat the things that were in Independence Day, and yet I have Frank still being a realtor, so I have to dream up things that he can do which are not repetitious of the prior book. But it doesn't mean anything. I think if one were a realtor, which I'm not, you would have all of those kinds of experiences in any 30-day period.
Gotcha. I know that for Independence Day, when Frank turned realtor, you consulted a guy named Michael Wilkinson to get basically, you know, some real estate terminology and all
I
that.
Did.
And I was wondering if you consulted him for this book because...
No, I didn't, but I consulted some other guys in New Jersey. A guy named Mike Featherston, who sells houses down in Trenton, New Jersey, and two guys on the Jersey Shore named Dennis Iacone and Paul Principe, who both sell houses on the Jersey Shore. Yes, I did do that, and I acknowledge them wholesomely in the back of the book.
Gotcha. Did you find a certain kind of, we were talking about this, the street names earlier, as well as your love of language, did you find, William Gaddis, I know when he did A Frolic of His Own, he basically went to a lot of law firms, looked at briefs, and found himself strangely immersed in the language and the boilerplate of the brief. Did you find something sort of similar with Bascom and
the realty
yeah.
language?
Yeah.
I just always found realty language to be funny. You know, topping wars and curb appeal and just all of the language of finance and real estate to be funny. And I found it attractive. And all I really wanted to do was, in Frank's kind of wry way, put it in play in the book.
Actually, I wanted to also talk about one other lingering sort of book that is in the book, the Great Speeches book.
Oh, yeah.
And it's interesting because there are certain aspects of Frank's life that have been sort of situated in, like, for example, you know, his house. And there are certain things that remain kind of the same. I know that we've been sort of discussing how instinctive your writing process is, but before writing this book, did you kind of think to yourself, like, what aspects from the previous books would appear in Lay of the Land or would be responded upon? Or?
Was the great speeches book in any of the prior books?
I think it was in The Sports Writer, actually.
Was it? Oh,
yeah.
Good yeah. for me. I didn't remember that. Something, you know, you just lose track of. I have a book of great speeches.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm always going back and looking at it for one reason or another. I never find anything in it that's usable.
Mm-hmm.
I never find anything in it that's particularly interesting. But I think that in itself is interesting and funny, that Frank would, just as he tried to show his son Paul how to become a free and independent human being by showing him a copy of Emerson's essays,
mm-hmm.
Frank is the kind of man who would repair to those kinds of monumental, speechifying, iconic writings of American heroes. George Washington's speech, whatever our great American speeches. And so that's just my attempt to kind of make Frank seem visible to the character.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and also kind of in a way traditional and wholehearted in a way, looking for received wisdom to give you help in modern day problems and failing to do that.
Likewise, what I was going to remark upon, since you have a great speeches book, I was wondering if you have a whole bunch of books that you're stuck on page 30.
Don't we all?
Yeah, well, of course we do.
Yeah, right.
How much of sort of the world around you ends up sort of finding their way into the Frank books?
Well, I mean, the world around me is in Maine for the most part. Not very much specific to Maine. For the most part, when I was working on this book and I needed a new dose of New Jersey, I would just go down to New Jersey and rent a car and get my tape recorder and drive around all the places that I thought were represented in the book and just read the landscape into my tape recorder and go back and transcribe it and see if there was anything interesting and usable there.
Really?
So, yeah, pretty much. I mean, it got to be a little bit of a problem in this way, that the book took place in 2000. So every year or so, I would have to go back and I'd have to read all of the New York Times's from the beginning of the year 2000 to the end of the year 2000 to replenish my memory and to replenish my storage of raw material for what I can both say is going on at that time. And so I can have reference to the political life at the moment.
Yeah. How many times did you end up going back to Jersey to check this out?
Countless times. Lots of times. I mean, I shouldn't say countless times. 20 times over a course of 5 years.
Well, did you find like the landscape sort of changing?
I mean, not, alas, very much. No. I was mostly interested in the names of stores, the names of streets, reacquainting myself with the physical landscape, where the streets went, how far it was from the ocean to the bay, all of those kinds of things. I didn't go with a plan. I just would go and get in the car and drive around.
So mechanics, I suppose, spatial mechanics that you could actually possibly transpose or at least sort of expand or work or transmute, this was of very sort of major importance to you in terms of sustaining the book?
Well, I didn't want to be garishly wrong about where Rhodes went. I didn't want someone reading the book who was from that part of New Jersey to quit reading the book because I made a mistake. There were some instances in which I had to change the landscape a little bit for reasons of my own convenience. But again, those things are background to me. They aren't foreground material. For me, what's in the foreground of the book is always what the characters are doing.
Well, jumping off of this point, what would be sort of an... I mean, there, you could be accurate, I suppose, up to a point.
That's right,
up to a point. What would that point be for you? When can you sort of give away and sort of like, oh, well, it's close enough in terms of like, you know, the background?
Well, Route 35 in New Jersey is a very odd road, and it's pretty much continuous from... fairly far north and up the Jersey Shore, all the way down far south in the Jersey Shore to the end of Barnegat Neck, for instance. And there are places where I made it continuous where it wasn't continuous, because I just didn't want to go to the trouble to describe and take reader time to specify what it actually did do in the town of Ortley Beach, for instance. So I just had it be continuous. And so my feeling was that, you know, 98% accuracy is close enough. Because fundamentally, as you say, there is a limit to how accurate you can be. I mean, as soon as you start describing things at all, certain accuracy goes out the window, because you are choosing words and you are choosing things to put into a description and leaving other things out.
One thing I wanted to actually also ask about while we're talking about landscape is going back to this notion of like whether the Bascom books are, in fact, you know, America or not. Haddam reminded me very much of Brewer in the Rabbit Angstrom books.
Oh.
In terms of it starts its decay in the second book, just like in the Rabbit books, Brewer starts its decay. And I was wondering if there was any sort of, you know...
Only read one of those Rabbit books.
Really?
Yeah. I never read... I read Rabbit is Rich.
Yeah.
I read it after I wrote the Sports Writer. Yeah. But as I remember about Brewer, at least I have a kind of an impressionistic sense of Brewer, it was one of those typical old ex-factory towns in eastern Pennsylvania, whereas Haddam has always been just a little burg without any industry. And which more immediately caused it to become suburbanized.
But at the same time, it seemed to me that, I mean, I sort of saw the similarity simply because the kind of crime that kicks in. I mean, Haddam's pretty pure by comparison in The Sports Writer, if we follow its trajectory over the books.
Yeah.
What was the kind of motivation? I mean, it's clearly not Brewer, but, you know.
Time passes.
Yeah.
Time passes. You have to, I mean, moreover, you have to account for the putative passage of time. I don't know if the kinds of changes that Frank ascribes to Haddam in Independence Day and then ascribes further to Haddam in The Lay of the Land are true on the ground or not.
Sure.
They seemed to me to be plausible as I described them, but I wasn't trying to report on anything that I knew specifically to be going on. But, you know, I'm a pretty good observer of things. If I've got Frank driving down the street And I see a bunch of punk teenage kids standing on the corner, which he refers to as the Haddam gang element. I feel fairly confident that if I can dream it up and have him think it, it's probably true. I mean, and we don't, any of us have to wonder if, in fact, crime is not on the upswing in American suburban life, because we know it is. Yeah. We know violence is on the uptick in suburban American life. It is, in fact, all of these things are true, whether I say them or not.
Yeah. I'm curious, how much of Frank's perspective can we really trust?
It's up to you.
Uh-huh.
That's entirely up to you. I mean, it's up to me to try to make it all be plausible. But at heart, as my friend Martin Amis has written, at heart, novels, literary novels, attempt to have a conversation with a reader. And so if Frank says that there is such a thing as the permanent period of life, and it causes you to think about your own life, and maybe you're 55, which you're not, but maybe if you were, you would come to the conclusion that, you know, I'm sorry, I just don't think there is a permanent period of life. I don't experience that, for instance. I'm not sure myself, Richard Ford, if I ever experienced that. So in that regard, the novel is always making provisional sallies of an intellectual kind toward you, the reader, which you then field and think about and decide whether or not to believe.
Well, it seems like, for example, there's the point late in the book where Frank is blanking out on the name of the Bagotians.
Yes.
And this is this is interesting on a number of levels, in the sense that you're preserving this really sort of genuine perspective. During the course of reading, he can't remember.
That's right.
Which I found quite interesting.
Yeah.
But simultaneously, this goes back to the sports writer, where, you know, he refers to his first wife as X.
Right. And he remembers her name.
Yeah,
though.
Exactly. Well, that he does.
Right.
But it's I guess this notion of sort of memory as part of Frank's perspective. How much of this do you sort of try to kind of implement into the Frank books?
Well, I mean, I try to have anything that he remembers be consistent with what happened before. Mm-hmm. That's probably as far as I take it, because I'm not trying to write a book which really does for its ultimate plausibility depend upon the plausibility of prior books. So, I mean, that correlation that you just drew between Frank blanking out on Mike Mahoney's name and
Mike Mahoney, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And whether or not he called Anne by her name in the first book, that to me is an interest that you have, but it isn't an interest that I have.
So for you, you know, these kinds of sort of subtextual details, for you, that you try to kind of remove yourself of these sorts of things?
I just try to take responsibility for the ones that I am and may come to be aware of, knowing full well that you, the reader, will bring to bear upon my book a whole lot of curiosities, a whole lot of mental habits, a whole lot of your own memory that I can't know anything about. So what I try to do is make the book as airtight as I can based on what I can figure out and what I do know, and trust that if you are faithful to the details of the book, you will get what I understand. And it may engage more than I understand, and I hope that that engagement will be useful to you.
So essentially it's a matter for the grad students to figure it all out.
I don't think that's what grad students do. I don't think grad students figure anything out.
There is no absolute answer.
Well, there is an absolute answer. The absolute answer is the book that I wrote and what I intended it to do. And the excellence of the book is whether or not I can make my intention and my execution absolutely the same. And then it passes on into the lives of others. But what passes on, if the book's good, is a fairly perfected document which they then take into their lives and do other things with that I didn't do when I wrote it.
Gotcha.
But it doesn't make the relative merits of the book, and it doesn't make what the book's about be just for anybody to assign. I assign what it's about. I tell you what it's principally going into. I tell you what the characters say and do and how they respond. And if you read that and you understand everything that I mean by it, then the book is a success.
But what if someone who doesn't understand everything you mean, you know?
Well, that may be just a failure of mine. Mm-hmm. I mean, I try to perfect books as thoroughly as I can. There will be things that I miss. There will be things that human beings just can't get right. Mm-hmm. And so it will either be deemed a fault by a reader, or it will be deemed something that the reader brought to the book, which the book never expected to have be brought to it.
But when there's a failure of interpretation along those lines, and this may also sort of explain how some of your books have received mixed reviews, which I would argue is not necessarily a bad thing. But
I've never written a book that got all good reviews.
Yeah.
You have to piss the right people off.
Gotcha. But I mean, is it the fault of the reader or the writer when there's a misinterpretation along those lines?
It can be one or it can be the other. I mean, I don't know the answer to that. You'd have to tell me the specific ones that you're thinking about, then we could talk about it. But I mean, people can screw up as readers, writers can screw up as writers.
Yeah. Okay.
But I don't think that has anything to do with mixed reviews.
Well, in terms of like a critic perhaps misidentifying some very pivotal kind of detail and sort of reacting with a review that, you know, that may be a detail that you as a writer completely, you know, intended it a totally different direction that another review or another reader has actually managed to successfully parse.
Well, then that's the reviewer's fault. Then that's the reviewer's fault. I remember that when I used to read reviews, and the last book whose reviews I did read was Wildlife back in the late 80s. And there's a scene in Wildlife in which the speaker of the book, who's a 17-year-old boy being remembered from a later age in life, has an episode in his house in which his mother is in her bedroom with a man who is not her husband. And that man walks out of the room and leaves the house. And the young boy, the teenage boy, is standing out in the hall. And his mother goes out in the hall following this man. And at some point, she turns around and she sees him. And he's shocked by this. He's shocked to see his mother because she's only got a house coat on or a slip or something like that. And she comes over because she's so mad and she slaps him. And Christopher Lehmannhaupt, fool as far as I'm concerned, said that this was a scene in the book which was about incest. Mm-hmm. Well, see, that's just crazy. That's just crazy. And that was one of the things that made me stop reading reviews entirely. Because if people are so wanton as to be able to work out their own hideous little gnarly, you know, interior lives on my book, that's going to happen, but I don't want to read it.
But simultaneously, you could just say, oh, well, this person's a fool and not react necessarily.
That's what I just did
say.
But at the time, I was shocked by it because it was so far-fetched. And I was also shocked by it because it was a significant review of the book, and it caused the book, to have fewer readers. And so I thought, gee whiz, it's hard enough to write books. I just can't constantly treat myself to the whims of these guys who purport to be good reviewers. And so I'm much happier not doing that anymore. I'm much happier not worrying about whether people will interpret my books right or wrong, and worry more about trying to make the books as airtight as I can.
Do you have a sort of select group of readers who you sort of
No.
have early drafts, or you just do it all yourself?
I do it with my wife, mm-hmm. and then I do it with my editor at Knopf, Gary Fiskejohn, and that's all. Mm. Yeah.
Gotcha. Less hands in the cookie pot.
Well, I just try to, I trust them, yeah. and I just try to limit the amount of input that gets in my brain when I'm in the middle of writing a book or at the end of writing a book and editing. Because I trust both of them to tell me things that I don't want to hear.
Yeah.
And I think they're both smart. They know what my intentions are. They know what my frailties are. They know what my strengths are. So I trust them. Whereas to ask someone else to do it puts them automatically on the hot seat, because then they have to tell me something that I may not want to hear, that I may react adversely to. Yeah. Or it may just be too much of an imposition on their time, because they're off writing their own books. Sure. So when I was younger, I used to show my books to Donald Hall, the poet. But then life went away that it wasn't going then, and I don't do that anymore. So it's just my wife and Fiskit John.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to actually ask you about the portrayal of Anne over Independence Day and Lay of the Land. Frank describes Anne as a bedrock literalist in Independence Day, and yet in Lay of the Land, his feelings are just completely far more, you know, complex once she makes her confession to him. And I'm wondering if the sort of, you know, this kind of shifting perception is, it kind of ties along with the, you know, with the Boghossians, which we just talked about. But I was wondering if this was another sort of instance of you just needing to have sort of really sort of shifting perceptions over the course of the three books.
Well, I think perceptions do shift about people, but I think more fundamentally it is, and of course, your perception of someone that you were once married to and then felt you were in love with and pined away for years, and then come later on in life to realize you really maybe didn't love enough at all. That's just human nature. That's just the things that can happen to us. And I think it may be conventional wisdom that that doesn't happen to us, that if we have a divorce in a marriage, that you kind of that you kind of stop right at that point, that time gets fixed way back then and doesn't change. I don't think that happens. I think perceptions change as people get older and their needs alter. But I was also quite interested in the whole issue of how we use the convention of character in our lives, which is that conventionally we think that a person has a kind of fixed and assigned character. His personality may waver here and there, or experience may cause behavior to alter, but fundamentally, we are who we are, if we have good character or if we have bad character. I just kind of don't believe that. And I was trying to write this novel, and it's actually specifically addressed in the book. I was trying to write this novel as if people actually don't have characters in the conventional sense, and are capable or liable basically unable not to change as they get older. Yeah. I mean, you think about what insects do. Insects sometimes go through all kinds of remarkable changes in their appearance, in their behavior, in their attitudes toward the outside world. And while I don't want to compare people to insects, because I don't think that that's right. But on the other hand, why is it, and is it at all demonstrable that our characters are unchangeable, and that our behavior within the understandings of our characters should be consistent? So in other words, for me, it was a kind of a semi-philosophical inquiry in the book about whether or not, and through all three books, whether or not people do have characters and whether or not they are determinative of our behavior, or are we not just as liable to, as much as do creatures in the animal world, really change radically.
Richard Ford, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ed.
Chatting with you.
Frankie and Johnny were sweethearts. At least that's the way the story goes. Frankie bought everything for Johnny, from his sports car to his Ivy League clothes. Oh, he was a man.